This episode of Bookworm is sponsored by Factor Meals, America's number one ready-to-eat meal kit. Go to factormeals.com/bookworm50 and use the code bookworm50 to get 50% off. All right, so we have no follow-up from the last episode. So I think I'm going to utilize this time at the beginning of this episode to talk to you, Joe Buehlig, about properties in Obsidian. Ding.
Ding, ding, ding. I got it right there. This is interesting. So I told Mike right before we hit record, like, I've seen the emails and I've seen the, like, announcement that this is a thing, but I haven't had a chance to read them all. I've just got done running a big conference the last 3 days, 4 days, and I'm, like, trying to get caught up on all the things, and this is one of the pieces that I've not had a chance to read up on. So please enlighten me, Mike. What in the world are Obsidian properties?
Well, before I get into that, I'll just say that if you were not aware, there are chapter markers in these podcast episodes. So if you don't care at all about Obsidian, you may want to skip the rest of this chapter and just go straight to the book. But Obsidian properties are kind of a big deal, I think. They add essentially database properties, a lot like at the top of a Notion document, to Obsidian. And there's different types of data that can be used there. Obviously, dates and checkboxes and list items. But what's really cool about it is that it creates a visual interface for the document level metadata that was a little bit hard for people who were new to it. You know, if you really dug into it and figured out the YAML stuff with the three dashes, and then you could put in like the tags, colon, and then document level tags and things like that, you could figure it out. You could hack it together. But this makes it a lot easier, a lot more visual. I'm not sure if you've seen any screenshots of it, but it's basically like these fields at the top of the document. It looks very much like a Notion document. Except the properties can also be moved to the sidebar, so you can like put them exactly where you want them and not have them clutter up your document or your note at all. The big thing I think that is cool about it, though, is it makes the application of metadata a lot more approachable for the average person. You don't have to be a total plain text nerd in order to leverage this stuff anymore, which I think is kind of cool.
What's wrong with being a plain text nerd?
Nothing, but most people are not going to do it.
So, okay, this is really good for me because I have seen many, many different ways of trying to handle document level metadata, things like tagging your daily notes or, in my case, tagging Bookworm notes and such. That way I can easily pull them together. Is that the idea behind this? But that's specifically referring to tags. I suppose if you were using different notes as like information about a plant, and you've got a whole bunch of different types of plants, and you wanted to put perennial versus annual and have a checkbox for one or the other at the top, then you could pull those together. Is that kind of the concept here?
Kinda. So I'll give you an example. This does not exist yet, but as I've been playing with properties, this is what I'm going to do. I am going to create a note in my Obsidian Vault for each of my fountain pens. And in the properties, you can put things like, this is the ink that's in there, and this is when it was inked, and this is when it was last cleaned, and this is the nib size. And obviously, those are all metadata, so then you use something like DataView, and you can sort all that stuff. You know, one of the things that I was doing with YAML back in the day was creating notes for each of the Bookworm episodes, and I would have my rating and your rating, and then a data view table for all of the files that were in the Bookworm folder, and then I could ascend it or descend it by Mike's rating or Joe's rating. The Bookworm stats page has basically eliminated the need to do a lot of that, which is really cool. Thanks, Joshua, for putting that together. There's lots of cool stuff you can do with data view, but now you can do it visually. You can, once the properties are in your Obsidian Vault, you can say, I want this property here, and then you just select the values. You can auto-complete, so it's not just putting in the plain text and hoping you got the incantation right.
That sounds so, I mentioned the plant thing because that sounds similar. Your fountain pen thing sounds similar to what I do in. I've got a perennial flower herb medicinal garden of sorts that I have at our house. And when I put together the garden of what I'm going to have in that for that year, I have notes for each of the types of plants that I have in that garden. But I have a lot of things like aliases for the type. So then I've got like the scientific name for it, what type it is it an herb, a flower, a vegetable, et cetera, et cetera. Is it an annual, perennial? How deep to plant it? How early you need to start it? I've got all that stuff as currently it's just in data fields to use through data view. Like that's how I currently do that. It sounds like this is a specifically built to purpose thing that would handle that. Am I catching on?
Yeah, basically. I don't know. I mean, a lot of people can use Obsidian without any sort of metadata whatsoever.
But it's no fun.
Yeah, I know. But I feel like I haven't been doing it very well. I feel like this gives people the foundation that they need to actually make their metadata useful. So I am considering a lot of really interesting ways to use this. Don't have it all figured out yet. By the way, if anyone has recommendations for books on how to structure metadata, I would love to hear your recommendations. Because I went searching, spelunking, shall we say, for books on how to structure metadata for like digital collections and something along those lines. There's a handful of textbooks that are all like $100 each, and they have like 6 ratings. And I'm not going to drop $100 on what looks like a textbook without knowing that it's really, really good.
Yeah.
I've been in the Obsidian forum, and other people have asked this question too, and I have not found anything that looks approachable. I want to do some research here and eventually like condense this down into you're just getting started with Obsidian properties. Here's how you use it in different like practical ways that aren't going to mess up your vault down the road. But as it pertains to metadata, I feel like it's all just kind of trial and error. You figure out what mistakes to avoid by making them, and then you have to go back and clean them all up. And I want to not have to do that, or at least I want to save other people from having to do that. So this is
why I went down the road of like the text file process for a long time, and borderline still do. And this concept of properties, like this is one of the first things I'm starting to come to grips with, because this now gets you into the proprietary side of it somewhat. Mm-hmm. Like it doesn't have to be. I'd be curious to see what those properties look like in a text file, like the raw text view of that. But that gets to be the tricky part with it, is like, okay, how do you transport that to another tool? Because that's forever been a thing that they talk about. The more you get into the plugins and the special ways of using it, the less flexible you can be, and the less portable it becomes. So like that can easily be a hang up for some people. Not necessarily for me in my case, because I know like I can write the scripts and fix all the things very quickly. But I also tend to not use some stuff like this, just because it does take a lot of work to fix it if you change your mind on how you want to do it. Now, as time has gone by, I've kind of started using it more and more, knowing that like the difficulty for me to write a script and fix it is actually very, very low. So it's very easy for me to fix them. So I'm more likely to try using it to begin with. But that said, it's just a thing I feel like people should be aware of.
Well, it's all still the YAML formatting. It's just now you can see it visually. It takes that YAML section and creates... I keep coming back to Notion. It's just like the property fields in Notion. Like you have those different lines underneath, except they're all based off of plain text, and you can move them to the sidebar if you don't want them at the top of your document.
Sure.
But
so if I have notes that with pre-existing YAML, it'll just show up that way?
Yep. Those will be properties. Oh, so and then you can change at a system level what types of values those properties are. So like if you just had plain text for dates, for example, you can choose a date, property type, and then it renders that with a calendar picker, and it's pretty cool. I think that everyone should take a look at it. The one piece of advice I'll give people who are going to go nuts with this is don't go too nuts. Because each value that you create, or each property that you create, adds to the list of properties. So just like tags, if you have a whole bunch of tags, you can kind of dilute the value of the tags that you have. So it's easy to say, I'm going to put 10 or 20 different properties at the top of every single document. And just from my own experience working with teams that have done that, there's like three or four that you actually use. And when you have all those properties and most of them are empty, you glance at it and you're like, oh, this isn't up to date. And then you don't trust any of it. So just be careful with some of that stuff. But yeah, it's fun. And I feel like it makes Obsidian more of a database application. Obviously, you got to figure out how to use something like DataView in order to really make the most of this. But it really does position Obsidian as a Notion alternative, which I never thought I would ever say, but totally true.
Once you get the sharing side of it nailed down, which is a little tricky with Obsidian.
That's true. You can do collaborative vaults, though. I was going to say, we should probably test that for Bookworm.
There you go. Test it for the Bookworm people who don't want to get into Notion.
Yep, exactly. All right. Thanks for letting me talk about something Obsidian related. We should probably talk about today's book now.
Okay, sounds good.
All right. So today's book is Life Worth Living by three separate authors who I'm going to butcher these names every single time that I'll say them. So maybe I just won't say them. They're three academics, and they're all teachers at Yale, I believe. Life Worth Living is actually a class that you can take as a Yale student. Okay, fine. I'll mention these names once, and then you can make fun of the way that I pronounce these. Miroslav Volf, Matthew Krosman, and Ryan McAnally Linz.
Well done. Proud of you, Mike.
Thanks. This is not the traditional type of book that we would cover for Bookworm. There are lots of parts. There are five official parts in addition to an introduction and an epilogue. So I think instead of trying to tackle this by chapter, we will tackle it by part. It is very difficult to discern, and it really doesn't matter, I guess, which author is speaking. It's not really written as the type of book where I'm the expert and I'm going to convince you about a thing. It's really designed to give you a bunch of questions and then you dig in and find the answers yourselves. So it's definitely checking the right boxes for me here at the beginning. But in addition to the 15 different chapters here, there are questions and basically a whole workbook that goes along with this. It's not officially a workbook. There is a workbook that you can buy. But there are basically questions to consider and exercises to complete at the end of each of these chapters, which I don't know about you, but I did not have time to go through and do those. I'm assuming you didn't either.
I got to the end of chapter one and I looked through the list and then I looked at my watch and said,
That's fair.
I was like, this would be amazing to go through. However, that it's going to take a lot of time. And I don't know that in 2 weeks' time, if you ignored the process of reading the book, I don't know that I have, if I had taken all of my reading time and put it towards answering these questions and doing the work, I don't know that I would have enough time to actually do it, not appropriately. So no, I didn't even attempt it.
Yeah, I mean, it's designed to be a college course. I forget if it's undergraduate or graduate. It doesn't really matter. It's a lot of work if you're going to go through the whole thing. All that to say that I feel like there is a lot of meat here, and we are not going to be diving quite as deep. That description is actually pretty punny if you understand the contents of the book, which we'll get into in a bit. But we're not going to be doing it the way the authors intended. I think there's some good stuff there. I'm kind of curious. We're not going to talk about the specifics of the exercises, but did you read them? What did you think of the exercises? Like one of the first ones I think was like make a life inventory and stuff like that. Did you think those sounded interesting or were you like, yeah, that sounds stupid. I'm not going to do that.
I wouldn't say I thought it sounded stupid. I think that reading those questions, because I read all of the expected work for you to do through this, and I can't say any of it struck me as that silly. It's all questions that are very inward focused, like you're trying to find answers to things inside yourself. And that seems to be a theme throughout the book. There's not going to be cut and dry answers to things. Like I can't tell you what the guide to what matters most really is, because there's just a series of questions that help you get there. And that's the part that they're guiding you through at the end of each chapter and what those questions are designed to help you with. So having read them, I thought they were super interesting. I feel like there's a lot of them that would have a lot of value, but my concern is like it's going to take a lot of time. Like again, this is for students in college. Again, I don't remember if it was undergrad or grad, but if you were to take the time to answer all of them, it's not a small commitment to do that. I think if you were to go through and pick out some of them and answer some of them, then it could be a little more doable. Personally, I'm probably not going to go back and do this just because of time, but I could easily say that, like there's a lot of value in doing it if you choose to do that.
Yeah. I agree. I'm kind of torn on whether I want to go back and try to follow the process. I thought most of the exercises and like the thinking time prompts and the questions that they give you were pretty good. There weren't any in there that just completely impressed me, I guess, which I kind of expected there would be, just given the whole positioning of this book and how, like, if this class was offered when I was in college, I totally would have taken it.
Sure.
But yeah, it's three academics who are not trying to convince you of anything, but they're trying to present a lot of different options and a lot of different questions and get you to consider things from different perspectives. Part of the way that they do that is they tell a whole bunch of stories from a lot of different backgrounds. They'll mention Bible stories, they'll mention Buddhist stories, they'll mention historical stories, they'll mention Confucius. I'm trying to think of any of the other different like major religions that they covered, but this is not a religious book. They're basically saying like these are the big questions that everybody is trying to answer. And they do a little bit of projecting maybe where they say this is how the Christians answer this and this is how the Muslims answer this. But I feel like for the most part, they do a pretty good job of identifying the main points without making a whole bunch of other assumptions. This is kind of hard to explain, but this is my big beef with a lot of non-religious books that try to bring up aspects of like Christianity or Bible scripture, is they'll look at part of it and they'll draw a conclusion. And I'm not a Bible scholar, but I have gone to Bible college and I know enough to know that that inference that you just made is totally wrong. I can see through that stuff and I don't even really know enough to point out the specifics of the inaccuracies, but I feel like they do a pretty good job of not overextending themselves to the point where they look silly, which
I think that's a good point in that, like whenever we read books and they do bring up scripture and it's like, you totally misquoted that because you know that. And if it's just something point blank wrong about how they've inferred what the scripture means, then I instantly question all of the references to things that I don't have the background to, because did they misunderstand that one as well? And they just, I just don't know if it's correct or not. Like that. And so then I'm second guessing the author the rest of the time.
Yep, definitely. So let's get into the actual book itself. Now, the first part here is the introduction. There's not a whole lot here. Some of what is here we actually talked about already. This is where they talk about they are three authors who have unique perspectives, and they teach this as a class together at Yale. One of the things that they mention, though, in the introduction, which is titled, "This Book Might Wreck Your Life," very appropriate introduction, I feel. They'll get into the specifics of the approach that they're going to take actually in the next section, so we won't get there quite yet. But yeah, anytime you start asking big questions, it can be uncomfortable when you start to get some answers. But finding out the answers is a worthwhile pursuit, they would argue, and I would agree. They do mention that questions are best tackled with truth-seeking communities. So figure out for yourself where that is for you. In some sense, the Bookworm podcast can be that, but I don't think that is quite what they're describing. I think they're talking more about a more regular, more intimate gathering of a handful of people. Again, recognize that this is typically taught as a college class. They see a small group of students multiple times per week for multiple weeks in a row. So that creates the space to consistently have these conversations. And I think they're right that that's the way that you get the most out of this, is by having conversations with other people who are on the same journey. And then the other thing here is that, like in poker, so that kind of alluded to the books that we've read by Annie Duke, you are not responsible for the outcome, but you are responsible for how you play your hand. And I feel like that is a perfect analogy for metaphor, whatever. That's a good way to think about why should we be asking these questions in the first place. If we can never be sure that we're going to get to the ultimate truth, why should we even pursue this in the first place? And I think you and I probably both have our own reasons for doing that, but I think they lay out a pretty good case why anybody, regardless of your belief system, should at least consider these questions.
Yeah, and just so you understand, like, some of these questions that they're referring to, we should probably detail out what the question is as well. But some of these questions that they have towards the end of that introduction are, what are your greatest hopes for yourself? What are your greatest fears? What brings you joy? What are your sources of peace? What memories trigger responses of regret or disappointment? What memories trigger responses of satisfaction or delight? What tends to make you feel embarrassed? Like, these are questions that are, and this isn't even the workbook part of it. Like, this is just the pre-book is where we're at right now. And that's why I'm saying, like, these questions are not something you're going to answer very quickly. And it's not something that you can do lightly either. Like, I can come up with some of these very quick, like very, very swiftly, but some of these I have to stop and process for a while, maybe go for a walk before I can get an answer to some of these. It's not a simple thing. Honestly, like, going through this introduction, it made me think of your life theme course quite a bit, Mike. Like, this whole book made me continue to come back to that, just knowing, like, some of the questions you had me process in the middle of that cohort. So for what it's worth, there's a little plug there for you as well. But
thanks.
That was something that continued to come up in my brain of, like, these aren't the exact same questions that I worked through when I was coming up with my life theme, but they're in the same vein. Like, it's in that same territory.
Yeah. And for people who are interested in that, by the way, the cohort is not available currently, but I do have a email course, which is 5 parts. It's a watered-down version of the cohort, basically. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes for anybody who is interested. But you're right. That's essentially what drew me to this book in the first place, was this sounded like another version of my life theme cohort.
Sure. So I kind of wondered, getting through the first few chapters, like, I wonder if this is either, it, like, in my brain, it's like, I wonder if this is where Mike got some of his life theme concepts. But I know the book was just written this year, and you've been on that for quite a while. So I was like, I know that that's not the case, but it's what made me, it made me question it for a split second.
Well, it's interesting because I don't think anything is probably truly original in the productivity space. It's all kind of a remix. And I realize that the life theme stuff that I've kind of put together is my version of it, but I'm constantly refining it. And so selfishly, I was going into this as like, well, maybe they have some really great ideas that I could glean some insight from and make some modifications to the course from. But the real reason that I picked this book in the first place was that it was a recommendation in the Bookworm Club. And when I saw it come across, I was like, this looks great. I'm going to pick it.
Nice.
Yeah. All right. So let's get into the first section here. Part one is titled Diving In. And there are just two chapters in this first part, What's Worth Wanting and Where Are We Starting From? And the big thing to be discussed at the top here is the four modes of being that they talk about. So they have this visual where you've got action and reflection on kind of like a Y axis. Okay. And at the very top is action. And then there's a bar that goes across, which represents autopilot. And then there are layers below that that are effectiveness, self-awareness, and self-transcendence. And then on the right side of this, for autopilot are habits, for effectiveness is strategy, for self-awareness is vision, for self-transcendence is truth. And then there's this little like plotted path where you start at autopilot, you go down, and then you come back up. So that's essentially what they're trying to do with the structure of this book, is that you are engaging with this topic right now. And I think they're kind of assuming that you've never really thought about this stuff before. Otherwise, like, why would you be starting at the autopilot? But the whole goal is to go down and then come back up. In fact, just let me read through the different parts. Part one is diving in. Part two is the depths. Part three is bedrock. So that's how we go all the way down, right? Part four, facing the limits. And then part five is back to the surface. So the journey they're trying to take us on is you go down and then you come back up. And there's some key actions and or questions that go along with each one of these areas. So autopilot, that's basically we do what we do because that's what we do. Effectiveness is what we do getting us what we want. Then there's self-awareness, which is what do we really want? And then self-transcendence is what is worth wanting. And that's the part where I'm not sure how anybody can actually coach someone in that particular arena. I don't know. I don't have a whole lot of examples of this, but it struck me as I was thinking about this, that most of the stuff that I've found, because I've tried to find like personal mission statement stuff. We did, what was the Donald Miller book, Hero on a Mission, right?
Yeah.
A lot of them don't go all the way down to the self-transcendence level. And maybe that's just the result of three academics getting together and making a course about this, where it's like, well, obviously we got to consider this piece. I don't think they can really, or anybody really can point you in the right direction once you get to that level. And I'm not sure if it's good or bad that they attempted to do this. What do you think?
Well, I know that like when I look at these four different levels, autopilot, effectiveness, self-awareness, and self-transcendence. The first two, the autopilot piece, which are your habits, and the effectiveness, which is basically strategy, those two, I think, those are the territory that probably 90 to 95% of our productivity and self-help books cover, business books as well. Like, that is the territory where most of them live. When you get to like the self-awareness piece, what do we really want? That particular component, I feel like we hit books on that sometimes. I'm thinking about things like the second mountain, like going towards the second level of things, like that concept. Or you could even maybe get into like mental models, maybe touches this a hair, where you're starting to put together like the meaning of life territory, and what is it that you actually want to accomplish in life. That territory gets covered sometimes. This what is worth wanting, I have a hard time like figuring out what is even meant by that. And we'll get to it a little bit, but like that concept is one that I don't know that I've ever touched on through anything I've read or even really discussed. So that one's a little bit like, either you are brilliant and this is a great idea and absolutely something that should be talked about more, or you're full of baloney. Like it's one of the two. Maybe it's somewhere in the middle, but I'm hoping that as we go through this, I'll get clean answers on my opinions on it. Cause right now I'm a little unsure of what to think of it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so let's put a pin in the self-transcendence stuff. I definitely want to come back to that, but that is going to be part three, I believe, the bedrock stuff.
Yeah.
The other thing that we should talk about here in this first section is, where are we starting from? That's chapter two. And they talk about the Walgreens motto, on the corner of happy and healthy. And they add to that in a very academic way, well, if you're going to be happy and you're going to be healthy, then you probably have a long life too. So they have the good life is... And this is not what they're like the theme of the book, but this is where they're starting: long, healthy, and happy. But then they go on to share examples of famous people who did not have a long, not have a happy, or not have a healthy life. And these stories were great. Martin Luther King Jr., we're familiar with. Abraham Lincoln, again, we're familiar with this, but they get into the depths of like his depression, basically. And that was an interesting wrinkle to the character that I never really understood. And then not healthy, where they talk about Lady Constance Lytton. I'm terrible with these names. But again, I'm not familiar with that story. But the point that they're making with each of those short stories is that you can't just buy into this narrative. You can have a long, healthy, happy life and not have a life worth living. Likewise, there are people who have been missing aspects of this, but everyone would agree that they actually lived a life worth living. So they end this whole section with a couple of wrong beliefs, which is that we can know what's good by what makes us feel good, and that doing good will automatically make us feel good. I guess this is effective in scrambling you at the beginning, which is probably their intention. Like, you've been on autopilot for a long time. You've probably been living your life in accordance with these basic belief systems and kind of unintentionally been optimizing for these three things: living a long, healthy, happy life. And they're trying to disorient you and get you to think that, you know, the default is not necessarily the best course of action, planting the belief like, well, you know, I've been following these wrong beliefs. Well, what is the right belief then? Well, I'm glad you asked. Let's go on to the next section. I feel like that's what the response that they're going for here.
Yeah. But it's also a good place to start from as well, because so many books and public speakers and stuff talk about how to have a happy life. How many times have we talked about this where that's not the answer? Like, that's not the end goal. Struggle, although we tend to avoid it, is actually a very big positive. So as much as we want to avoid things that are difficult, that's where a lot of the joy in life can come from. And although they didn't spell that out here, they're saying that this happy, long, healthy life isn't necessarily the target, even though that's what many people find as like the bullseye for their life success. But if you were to hit that bullseye, you end up having lots of regrets, which they've shown many, many, many times. So that's not the end game, even though they don't really tell you what the end game is. They're just getting you to ask the questions.
Yeah, I mean, I get the approach. And I think for part one anyways, it works. Let's go on to the next part, which is part two, the depths. And in this section, there are four chapters. Chapter three, who do we answer to? Chapter four, how does a good life feel? Chapter five, what should we hope for? Chapter six, how should we live? This is where it started to lose me a little bit. They basically structure these chapters in a way where they tell a story and they try to make a point or introduce a key concept, and then they wrap it up with some questions to get you to think about that particular thing. So, like, for example, with chapter four, what is a good life, or how does a good life feel? They introduce the topic of utilitarianism, which is doing whatever brings the most happiness or pleasure. And there's a story that goes along with it. And the story is pretty well done. All of the stories in the book are pretty well done, I feel. However, utilitarianism, this is essentially not just your happiness, pleasure, but maximizing happiness, pleasure for the entire group, right? And then they talk about how pleasure, what feels good, can actually lead us away from what really matters, and talk about how sorrow is just as important for a good life as pleasure. So you leave the chapter with more questions than answers. And again, that's intentional because there's a workbook associated with this. So had we actually gone through this, like a semester course that it is, I'm sure we would have some different reactions to this. But because of the format here for Bookworm, we cranked through it in a couple of weeks, and we're wrestling with the content. Now, a lot of the content that they share and a lot of the ideas that they introduce, I've heard different versions of these before. I'm not sure how familiar you are with this kind of stuff, but it didn't feel like anything was completely new from anything in this book. But this section right here, part two, the depths, this is where we're starting to get into the effectiveness and the self-awareness section. So this is where is what we do getting us what we want, and what do we really want? And I don't know. I mean, I didn't actually take a whole lot of notes in this particular section because I feel like maybe I've wrestled through this already. Maybe I have a version of this that I've kind of figured out, and so I've gone through some of this already. I don't know. I agree with some of their minor points, you know, that money is a form of influence or power, and they talk about a AAA vision where we have things that are available, accessible, and attainable to us. They talk about this idea of moral alchemy, where we're balancing the needs and wants of individuals in a way that promotes the good of the group, like checks and balances, things like that. But they also get into like full-on academic mode, and I have a little bit of a reaction to that. I feel like they talk about consequentialism, ethics concerned with the consequences of our actions. That term consequentialism just kind of rubs me the wrong way. Because I like the idea, but it's like, oh yeah, what you do doesn't exist in a vacuum. When you do something, it affects the people around you. That seems very basic. And I get like that's because of the way I was raised and the beliefs that I hold. But it did feel sometimes like the way that they describe some things, especially in this section, it's like, while the topic sounded like it's right in my wheelhouse, at this point, it feels a little bit like we're speaking different languages.
I think some of my, because I'm with you on this, in like the angst with this particular part, the who do we answer to? Really, the answer is ourselves. How does a good life feel? What should we hope for? How should we live? It's all left with questions at the end so that you can work through the process of figuring out what the answer to those questions are yourself. The problem with that is that what happens if my answer to that question conflicts with your answer to that question. And by me achieving success in my answer, it takes away from success on your answer. Do you get where I'm going with this? Like this is like the whole relativism thing that I feel like is creeping into this, because then it means that how should we live? Well, it kind of depends on how you feel about a certain topic. That's the air that I got from this. Mm. Now, they don't say that, to be clear. Like, that is not something that they point out. But because the answers to these questions aren't founded in something concrete, and it allows it to be flexible, this part, they lost me on this. This is where I started to really question the entire validity of the book. And I started to wonder, what are we getting into? Like, what is this, Mike? What did you do? That's what I started to wonder. I want to be clear. There are some good points in here, and some of these questions are absolutely 100% things you should ask of yourself. So I want to be clear on that. It's not 100% like all. Yes, I think you get my point. So I'm not 100% against them. I'm just saying, like, this is where it started to lose me, and that the fact that there's not any basis that this stands on, and that it's dependent on how I process something, that's the part that got me a little bit questioning of the validity of this.
That's interesting. I think I agree with you, although I never really realized that as I was going through this. I just thought this section felt awkward.
Yeah. I think I'm like, when I got through, I think it was chapter 5, what should we hope for, the third chapter in this part. And it was because we came out of the chapter, how does a good life feel? It got me wondering why we were asking questions that were so, like, they didn't have any true basis. Now, I'm coming at this as a Christian who stands on a Bible, and, like, that is my concrete foundation. So because of that, if I answer these questions in a way that conflicts with that, to me, that's then wrong. But I know that not everybody's going to view things that way.
Yeah, I guess you don't necessarily have to, though. If you've thought about the creed by which you live your life, then this section feels unnecessary. But if you have never considered that before, I think I understand where they're coming from.
Sure.
This episode of Bookworm is brought to you by Factor Meals. With the busy fall season just around the corner, you might be looking for wholesome, convenient meals for jam-packed days. I know as we go back into school, things are crazy, but Factor, America's number one ready-to-eat meal kit, is there to help with chef-prepared, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door. Save time, eat well, and stay on track with your healthy lifestyle. Too busy to cook but want to make sure you're still eating well? Well, with Factor, you can skip that extra trip to the grocery store and all the chopping, prepping, and cleaning up too, while still getting the flavor and nutritional quality that you need. Factor's fresh, never-frozen meals are ready in just 2 minutes, so all you have to do is heat and enjoy. This is my favorite part about Factor meals. Sometimes my wife and my kids are gone for the day and I'm home alone. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time cooking, but I don't want to go out to eat either. Factor gives me healthy options that I can eat at home and I can prep on my own in just a couple of minutes. They're so easy and they are so tasty. You can choose from over 34 weekly flavor-packed, dietitian-approved meals, which are all ready to eat in 2 minutes or less. And if you really want to level up your lunch options, you can go with the Gourmet Plus options, which are prepared to perfection by chefs, and they are ready to eat in record time, so you can treat yourself to upscale meals with premium ingredients like broccolini, leeks, truffle butter, and asparagus. If you're counting calories, try the Calorie Conscious options, which are just as delicious but have less than 550 calories per serving. And if you need an extra boost to help you support your fitness and wellness goals, then get the Protein Plus meals, which give you 30 grams of protein or more with each serving. No matter what your dietary needs, Factor has you covered. So this August, get Factor and enjoy eating well without the hassle. Simply choose your meals and enjoy fresh, flavor-packed meals delivered straight to your door, ready in just 2 minutes. No prep, no mess. So head to factormeals.com/bookworm50. That's BOOKWORM50. and use the code Bookworm50 to get 50% off. That's code Bookworm50 at factormeals.com/Bookworm50 to get 50% off. Our thanks to Factor Meals for their support of the Bookworm podcast. Yeah, let's go to the next section, because this is the one where I feel like you'll get some real benefit from considering some of this stuff, but I think I might have issues with some of the ways that they assemble it. So let's talk through it. Okay. Maybe you can help this make sense. So part three is Bedrock, and there's two chapters here. Chapter 7 is the recipe test. Chapter 8 is the really big picture. And the recipe test, I think this is a bold move, but I think it's effective in thinking through, like, well, what is a life worth living, to go back to the title, right? There are different aspects that make up this good life. And they talk about a life being like a recipe. And for a recipe to be good, you have to have different foods from these different categories, three basic food groups, they call them, of a good life. One of them is agency, one of them is circumstance, and one of them is effect. So stoicism is one life recipe that elevates the agency area above others. Utilitarianism elevates the affect part above the others, and Confucianism elevates circumstance above the others. And the thing we have to figure out is, how are we going to handle the inconsistencies? Will we ignore them? Will we view them as opportunities? Because they're never as simple and black and white as they appear to be. They talk about Confucianism in here and how he never actually defined the way that a lot of... I'm not a Confucianist. I don't know.
You're not confused?
Well, I mean,
sorry, I couldn't pass that one.
Yeah. I don't understand the frame of reference for the way. I'm assuming that's kind of like a idea that is communicated in that belief system, which I just don't understand. But basically, he was saying that Confucius never defined the way. It was the followers, I guess, of this religion, I don't know, that define the way. So my big takeaway from this is, at this point, we're trying to answer questions that you and I have answered with religion, without religion, but then we're talking about religion and sharing a bunch of different examples of how people use religion to answer these questions. Now, I commend them getting people to ask the questions, even if they don't consider themselves to be religious. One of my big takeaways from doing the Life Theme cohort, which is part of my faith-based productivity community, right? It says it on the tin, but I had a bunch of people that were in there and from all over the world who they didn't consider themselves to be religious. They were just interested in this idea of applying their values to their productivity and their actions. Again, recognize I have a bias here and I'm coming at this from a certain direction, but this feels like a lot to grok at this point. And then at the end of chapter 7, they're basically saying, we're never going to figure it all out anyways. There's always going to be inconsistencies. I feel like if you go into this as someone who is anti-religion, there's a good chance you are that way, because there is an element of faith involved. And you can't reconcile everything in the accounts in your head, right? So I feel like this right here would throw some people for a loop. It's like, yeah, you know what? You're not going to be able to figure it all out anyway, so don't worry about it. I think there's a certain person who's getting into this and like, what? Screw this. They chuck it and walk out of the class.
Yeah, I can see that for sure. Because like even... So again, by the time I got here, I was in skeptic mode, but the title of chapter 7, the recipe test, What does a test give you when you're done?
A result.
A result based on known answers, right? So we're now trying to put this recipe test together with these three components, but then we're told that it can change and that the answer isn't always the same.
Yeah.
It's not how a test works. So, like, that's the part that now I get, like, sometimes, like, with English, you're writing a paper, or you can get a test, and there's a test that's a written paper, and it's subjective. Like, I get that, but that's not where my brain was at the time. But I was very much like, that's not the point. Like, don't tell me that there's these three pieces and that you're going to show me how to put them all together and then don't put them all together. That's super frustrating for me.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's why when I read the recipe test as the title, I'm like, oh, I think I see what you're going to try to do. I hope this works for you. And it kind of doesn't.
Yep.
It's good in theory, and it like, you go into this and you're like, oh, I want this to make sense. I want this to be true, you know, because it's convenient. And if I could just think about it this way and base it off of this other thing that I understand, like, that would make this simple. And but they can't quite get there.
Yeah.
Question is just too big. Which actually leads to the next chapter, which is the really big picture. And this is where they talk about where are we, cosmology, and who are we, anthropology. Talk about tribalism, Ray Kurzweil's six stages of the universe, which is interesting, but again, like, I don't really know what you do with this. The six stages of Ray Kurzweil's, six stages of the universe, by the way, they do a good job of condensing this, I feel, to physics and chemistry, biology and DNA, brains, technology, the merger of human technology with human intelligence, and then the universe wakes up. So you read that and you're like, oh, we're at stage five. And he basically, I guess I'm talking about Ray Kurzweil, but really it's the authors who are interpreting this. So they basically are saying that, well, again, that's not really fair either, because they say we're going to present all these different perspectives and you got to figure out what you believe about this. So I'll go back to Ray Kurzweil. Basically saying that the universe has lots of different iterations of this. This is the cycle, then it hits reset and it starts all over. And the net result of that is kind of a dread of the Matrix style, the robots are coming. And then you couple that with all the stuff I see and read and hear about people who have never really experimented with generative AI, but they are absolutely terrified of it. I don't know. I mean, like, you could hear all that stuff and be like, oh yeah, this is confirmation. Rick Kurzweil was right. We better be careful. I tend to think that this is a little bit sensationalized, and yeah, the universe will end someday, but not like that. I don't know, but at the end of this chapter, they're kind of leading you into that, they're kind of leading you down that road, which I know they talk about how they're trying not to do that, and all of the opinions and the perspectives that they're sharing are simply for diversity's sake, and you can be exposed to a bunch of this different stuff. There's nowhere else really to go with this chapter. It's kind of like, well, if we can't really draw any conclusions, or we can't really take anything away from this, because you could be at that point, the merger of human technology, human intelligence, and oh my gosh, the universe is going to wake up and disappear at some point in the future. How does that actually change anything? Right? You just do the best you can with what you have. And so it kind of feels like, well, why is this even here in the first place?
Yeah, I'm 100% with you, because there's so much of this that's like, okay, so you're just trying to show me how small and insignificant I am? Like, I'm already aware of that, but that doesn't really help me here. And I get that we are, you know, a cog in the wheel of life, and I get that, but I can't quite put my finger on why this is here. Like, coming back to, like, the structure of the book, maybe this is that transcendent piece that I don't understand. And maybe my brain is just too small to grasp what they're trying to share. Absolutely, 100%, these could be the answers to it. But given my lack of knowledge on this and my current background, I have to say this is just weird and I don't understand it. I don't know why this is here, other than just they wanted to rant about how small we are. Like that's that's really the only thing I got out of it. Now, I've been through those exercises before where, you know, again, I'm bringing up Christianity and such quite a bit because they bring it up a fair amount in the book as well. They bring up a lot of Bible references in this. I don't know what their like personal beliefs are now that I am saying that. But because of my background, like I've been through that process of trying to understand like how big God is and how small I am. So like I've been through that exercise many, many times at this point. This feels just like another one of those, only without the experience of how big is God. Like it's just here's how small you are. Like that's which is strange to me.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do with this one.
Well, I understand why they got here because of the model that they anchored everything off of in chapter one. If you're going to go all the way down to the depths and then come back up, like you do have to consider some of these giant questions.
Maybe that's it. I'm still processing. Maybe the reason for that is like they're trying to get you go all the way down into this transcendent piece so that you can start to see like your role in the broader world. Like maybe they're just trying to help you understand your place in and amongst everybody else. Maybe that's it. I'm trying to find the doubt, like the benefit of a doubt here. Like I'm trying to find it.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what they're trying to do. But again, having read 170 some books for Bookworm, probably about 500 of these types of books overall, I feel this isn't the most effective approach for most people. Again, they're adapting a Yale class, so maybe it fits perfectly when you stretch it out and you have more time to go that deep. I don't know, but I agree. It kind of feels like, why did we go there? Now, let's go into the next section, if you're cool with that. Part four is Facing the Limits, and this is before we technically go back to the surface. That's actually part five, but I think this is my favorite section in the whole book. And yes. This is all about when things go wrong. And chapter nine is when we inevitably botch it. Chapter 10 is when life hurts. Chapter 11 is, and there's no fixing it. Chapter 12, when it ends. So this is where we start to wrestle with, you know, like chapter 12, when it ends, we can't escape the fact that we're all going to die someday. When we inevitably botch it is, you know, as much as you try to live a perfect life, you're going to mess it up. When life hurts and there's no fixing it, you know, there's pain involved here and you're not always going to be able to find a solution to that, which I think is probably most people anyways would want to alleviate the suffering. I really like this whole section. There's nothing really specific in here that stands out to me is like this is a new revelation and this just really rocked my world. But this is kind of the stuff that I was anticipating, the types of questions we were going to be wrestling with throughout the entire book, not the Ray Kurzweil stuff, et cetera. Now there are like little things in this section that I could nitpick, like their definition of repentance. I don't think is quite the same as my Christian definition of repentance because they define repentance as confession, make things right, and restitution, do what's right. Whereas our religious belief system would say, well, it's up to us for the confession part, but the restitution part is not up to us, right? So it feels a little bit weird to put that in the hands of the individual, but I don't necessarily think that that's wrong. I think that probably is the thing that we should be trying to do when we inevitably botch it, because that's the chapter that this is coming from. But the, I guess if I had to pick one thing that really just kind of stood out, well, two things that stood out to me from this section. First comes from chapter 9, where being wrong without realizing it feels exactly like being right, which is why you have to ask all these questions. Because you can convince yourself, especially if you surround yourself with people who think and talk and act just like you, that you have the corner on the truth and no one else knows anything, and wake up, sheeple. But it's much more effective, and it's honestly much more fun when you consider that you might be wrong. And just realizing that you can't trust your feelings. You can't trust the strength of your convictions. Strong convictions lightly held is that saying. That's kind of the goal here. I constantly want to be putting things under the microscope and saying, is this what I still believe? And then the other one comes from chapter 12, that what we do only matters if time is finite. I never thought about that before, but that was interesting, because if we're going to live forever, yeah, it doesn't really matter what we do today. If we don't do the right thing, we can try again tomorrow. So I like that, the whole reason for caring about productivity in the first place is because time is a finite resource. It's the one resource we can never get any more of. So if you threw out that constraint, that changes the whole discussion.
Yeah, I have to agree with you that this is my favorite part in the book, because it kind of brings us back to reality of, like, you know, we're going to screw things up, and trying to understand how, like, the whole, if we lived forever, nothing would matter what we do. Well, because you've got infinite amount of time to, you know, try again tomorrow, or patch up that relationship, or build a new one. Like, you've got gobs and gobs of time, so who cares how long it takes? Whereas because we have an expiration date, it means that you only have so much time to take advantage of the relationships and the energy that we have right now. So as a result of that, you know, whenever you have situations when we inevitably botch it, as they say, there are some things you need to do to either learn from or recover from that situation. And I'm with you, like, their definition of repentance doesn't really mesh with me at all. But I think some of that is, you know, we're coming from a background where that's something that's talked about quite a bit. That's some of our angst with this, is like, this is coming at it from a stance that is attempting to cover a territory that we both live and breathe a lot, and yet they're not calling it out point blank, and they're trying to, like, dance around it. Maybe that's what's going on. Martin in the chat thinks they're all Christian, according to the Amazon blurb. Maybe that's true, and maybe they're trying not to be point blank with it, but I kind of wonder if there's some underlying stuff here that would make this a lot more clear that's just not being said. But I have no way of knowing that, because I'm probably not going to get all three of them in a room to ask them.
Well, let me just say that with any sort of community that assembles around a shared belief system, the natural tendency is going to be to just accept certain things as true, because you have this either explicit or implicit shared belief system, and this is the way things are. So we don't question those things when we're with those groups. And I think that it is absolutely valuable to question everything. And so I don't, maybe what's happening here is just being academics coming at this, the same topic that, you know, we have these, for lack of a better term, blind spots. I don't really feel like they're blind spots, because I feel like I've considered them and I've made my decisions about them and I'm open to changing my mind about things, but I haven't. Yeah. So I'm willing to entertain a different perspective, And it could be just that, you know, they're talking about things in terms that we're not used to hearing. I don't really know. I don't know. I guess at this point, I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt with the stuff like defining repentance. Because if you were to poll the people at my church, I'm not sure how many of them would even have a definition of the word repentance. We all kind of understand what we think it means, but it's one of those things that's foundational. And because it's foundational, we never go deep enough to consider it. And that is the model that they introduced at the very beginning, is like, we're going to go all the way down and then we're going to come all the way back up. So I think it's good that they're forcing us to get outside of our comfort zone with some of this stuff, even though it feels a little bit clunky to me in some places.
And I think to go with that thought there quick before you move on. I think that point right there is one that I mentioned it early on, like either this is a brilliant thing or I'm just not smart enough for it. And there's a part of me that wonders if it's the latter of those two, because there's a lot of it that just like, why is this even here? I don't understand this. I want to leave room for the fact that like, I'm not at a spot where my intelligence can handle that conversation. And maybe I've got some growth to do before this hits me like it should. So I want to make sure I leave room for that, because obviously I don't know everything.
Well, possible, but I think the other thing that might be happening here is that because they're trying to go deep, come back up, and they're looking at so much material, it's possible that in any given situation there is a certain aspect of the material or a certain type of question that really triggers is the wrong word, but resonates with an individual based on their upbringing and their experiences. Like that's the question that unlocks the new perspective. But it's hard to tell which one it is, because we're not doing it the right way. Because we're just cranking through this book in a couple of weeks. So I think if you were to tackle this, like let's just assume each chapter is a week in the class, right? Some weeks you're like, I didn't really care for that class. There might be some weeks though where it's like, oh yeah, that's the one. That makes the whole semester worth it. But we kind of miss that, I feel, because of how fast we're going through this. And I don't think
that very well could be.
I don't think they are trying to find, you know, this is the one question that the average person should be asking. Although that would be an interesting perspective for a book as well. All right, let's go into the last part here. Part five is back to the surface. And this is where we're bringing this back around. Chapter 13, it turns out we have some work to do. Chapter 14, change is hard. Chapter 15, making it stick. I like this section a lot too. So it seems like just the going down part was the
it's just that the bottom of the dip where we're in that self-transcendent thing.
Yep. So the things that they call out here that I really like, actually, there's something I like from each one of these chapters. The first one, they talk about how insights are one thing, but action is another. And they use the example of Thomas Jefferson writing the words, "All men are created equal," while holding hundreds of slaves. And I have heard that story used previously as an accusation. And from where we are today, we could say rightfully so. But I like the perspective that they have here, because essentially what they're saying, without saying it, is no matter where you find yourself in the scope of time, if you don't put wisdom into practice, it withers and dies. So the question we need to be asking ourselves is, am I doing the right thing with what I know or what I believe? Am I practicing? And then the other thing that kind of strikes me about this is, this was a small error in judgment. Now you could say small, it wasn't small. He impacted hundreds of people's lives. That is true. But it wouldn't have taken a whole big mindset shift, I feel, for that to be a completely different story. In fact, they share a different story about somebody else, and I didn't jot down the name, who actually did free all of their slaves when they became aware that this is wrong. And I would like to think that I would take the same approach. If I was shown the error of my ways, I would change. I don't think any of us know that until we're put in that position, but that's the goal here. Chapter 14, they talk about how change is hard and how you should design your world to nudge you in the desired direction. And that gets back to the book Nudge that we actually covered. I forget which episode that was. Was a long time ago, the one with the elephant on the cover.
Surprised you don't remember every book and every number.
I remember a shocking amount of them because I do all the show notes.
More than I do.
Yep, I do all the show notes. So I've got a Raycast search that finds the book titles on the site for me. But there's some I don't even need the search. I'm like, oh yeah, 42. That's how to read a book.
When it's mentioned in like at least every other, if not every third, episode.
The other thing that is interesting in this chapter, though, is that they say art is how we express our truest selves. And that is a small statement that could easily be overlooked, except that I just got done writing a whole big email course on the creativity flywheel. And I was like, yes, absolutely. Because I've been wrestling through how to communicate this myself. But I really believe with that creativity flywheel that there has to be some sort of output. And I get pushback occasionally when I talk to people about this because, oh, I'm just not creative. I don't write anything for public consumption. I'm not a podcaster. I don't have a YouTube channel. Doesn't matter. I always argue you are creative. You have to have some way of expressing yourself. And so this was basically a admonition I felt like that we should all try to be artists. And then chapter 15, they talk about the Ignatian Retreat. And this was cool. The Ignatian Retreat is 30 days, I believe. And the bigger goal, the bigger idea here is that spiritual awakening is not a one-time thing. However, they talk about this examine, E-X-A-M-E-N. I don't know if that's how you actually pronounce it. But the goal of the examine is to notice God's presence in the day-to-day, and it's broken down into these different parts, gratitude, review, sorrow, forgiveness, and grace. And this obviously has parallels to journaling. But also, I would argue, if you extend it a little bit further, somewhere between the 30 days and 15 minutes that this is, you've got essentially the personal retreat that I am a huge fan of. So I don't know. I feel like we're on the same wavelength here as we wrap up this book.
Yeah, this is so obviously like we're getting back up into the territory where we're talking about habits and actions, right? Which is a lot of the territory where we tend to gravitate. And they start that off with like, we've got work to do. You got to get, you know, just sitting around and thinking about this is not going to accomplish anything. So you need to act on it. I've got a thing on my home screen on my phone that says words don't matter, deeds do. That comes from a book we read, I don't know, 5 or 6 ago. I don't remember what it was. But I know that phrasing stuck with me. It's like, words do matter. Like, obviously we read books and we think that they matter, but that's not the intention behind that phrase. It's purely that I can say a lot of things, but unless I act on it, it doesn't really have much weight. To me, like this last part tends to try to bring that to life. And just saying like, you know, there are many, many things that you can process mentally and that you can spend some time in your, you know, thoughts trying to come up with the answers to these questions. But until you take the time to act on them, it really doesn't come to fruit at all. And I think that's where some of the creativity piece, like they're offering options for how those actions could come about. And I think it's great. You know, I love to see, you know, when authors tell us to be creative like that in those ways. And I think to your point, that doesn't always have to mean like art per se. People tend to say that, you know, being creative is art, but art has, it's a very loose term, I would say. I think of art in a lot of different ways. Like, I obviously spend a lot of time behind a soundboard. That's like, if anything, that's the area where I spend a lot of time developing art in music and taking the instruments and the singers that I am given and their talents as well, and then trying to put that all together into a cohesive song and trying to bring the energy of that song out. So that's my form of like creativity and artwork of sorts. So I am 100% on board with this. I like this part. So I didn't get all confusolated on this one. I understood it, I think.
Nice. All right. And then the last part is the epilogue. And this is titled What Matters Most. It's basically an admonition to live a life worth living. They talk about essentially, paraphrasing, but do what you can not to live a trivial life. Your life is too valuable to be guided by anything less than what matters most. And on page 283, there's a quote that I really liked. What matters most will not clamor for your attention. It's really loud. It's almost never flashy. It's easy to miss, and it can be hard to hold on to. So again, that is a big reason why I really like the personal retreat idea. I'm not going to go too deep into that, but I will share, as we record this, I just recorded a YouTube video on my last personal retreat. I walked through the whole template that I use in Obsidian, and you can actually download that for free. So if you're interested in doing a personal retreat in Obsidian, there'll be a link to that in the show notes, and you should go check that out. But a real effective way, I feel like, to wrap all this up, before we get into style and rating, I guess I don't want to talk too much about the whole journey that they attempted to bring us on, but just in isolation with this epilogue, I feel like it's an effective conclusion to the very long book.
Yeah, I think in the epilogue, the quote that you mentioned, what matters most rarely clamors for our attention. Like that concept is like, that's one of the few quotes out of the book I wrote down as well. And I think it's a great place to end it, because the things that we tend to put on a pedestal, like this is the most important thing to me, they're almost never the thing that are right in front of you and that just naturally happen and you don't have to work at. That's not the case. Like, it's almost always the thing you have to sacrifice and work your tail off for. So it's not going to be the thing just saying, hey, pay attention to me. It's always going to be the thing that wants to hide behind the corner, and you have to seek it out. Otherwise, it's not going to happen.
Yep. All right. Anything else before we get into action items?
It's a really long list of action items, so we better get after it.
Well, I do have one that I was sort of on the fence about, but I think I am going to pick up the workbook that I saw on Amazon that goes along with this. I don't know, maybe I don't need the actual workbook. Maybe I just need to spend a little bit more time with some of these exercises and action items, but I'm not committing to giving it the whole effort that they're asking for. But I do think it's possible that there's a little bit more to be mined here than we got in the 2 weeks that we had to crank through the book. So I intend to pick up the workbook and kind of pick at this here and there and consider some of these questions and go through some of these exercises when I have a little bit of extra time. Obviously, a life theme is a thing for me. And so, as I shared before, I feel like there's elements of this that can give me some new perspective and some new insight, some new dimensions to some of the stuff that I'm already doing. But that's also the trick, is figuring out how do I make this system or this process my own. And I don't have anything specific that I am looking to get from this. It's quite possible I spend several hours going through some of these exercises and I'm like, yeah, I like what I have already a lot better. But I want to at least dig a little bit deeper.
Yeah, I don't have any action items on this. None. Other than, right, like, maybe think about it, but I don't foresee that happening either. So, sorry. No action items on this one from me.
That's all right. Okay, style and rating. This is going to be tricky.
Tricky or easy?
Depending. Well, as already said, we didn't do this the right way. So giving this any sort of rating based on our experience is kind of unfair, but also this is the podcast at this point, 175 episodes in, or 177, I guess, actually.
Yep. It's getting ready to correct you. Yep.
Yeah, this is what we do. So from the bookworm perspective, I feel that cranking through this material in a couple of weeks is good and beneficial, but it's not going to give you what the authors intended to give you. That's not necessarily a bad thing, although the argument could be made it is when they are three academics at Yale trying to walk you through the material that they teach in a semester-long course. I am glad that I read this. I am thankful for the recommendation. There are some things that I will continue to noodle on from here. The things that I did not like about this book were, number one, the approach where we start up high, we go down, and then we come back up, which is a little bit surprising to me because I feel like the way that that is framed at the beginning, that is somewhat of an effective way to do it. However, having gone through this, I think my approach would not be, okay, start at the top and we're going to go all the way down to the bottom and then back up. But it would be to shine a light on what you are currently doing and is that getting you the results that you were hoping for. So my version of something like this probably would not have four layers. It would probably only have three, and instead of starting at the top and going down, it would be sort of establishing a baseline, and then, okay, let's build on top of that. The whole, like, arc thing felt a little bit disorienting, but that's just me. Again, you've got a longer time frame. Maybe that works a lot better. Some of the stuff in here I had a hard time reconciling. We kind of talked about the recipe test and the really big picture stuff and all the stuff at the beginning. I feel like not unfairly, but it definitely anchored me on a lower score than it would have if we just started with part four. If we did part four through the epilogue, it feels like a totally different experience to me. So really, this is a tale of two different journeys here, one on the way down, one on the way back up. I feel like the one on the way back up felt a lot different, left me with a lot of great food for thought. But the stuff at the beginning, like the whole first part of the book, I was kind of like, where are we going? I was looking for something to grab onto, some sort of reference point. And didn't really, really get it. I am struggling with what to rate this. Going back to the discussion on the Obsidian properties, I've been thinking about creating a property for book ratings in Obsidian. However, there is no half star Unicode character that renders in Obsidian. So I am hearing David Spark's voice in my head saying, you guys got to quit using these half star ratings. And so I think I'm going to try to do that. So that leaves me with 3 stars or 4 stars. This is tough. I think I'm going to go with 4 stars, just because I don't think I've found very many books that are willing to consider these questions. And I think that there is a reason for that, because it is difficult to do. And I can nitpick, a lot of stuff with especially the first half of this book, but my overall feeling at the end of it, I think this is worthwhile. I think I would recommend this book for a lot of people till I write mine. I don't know that I've got a better resource to send people to.
I'll recommend this one until I have mine done, and then I'm not going to recommend it anymore, because then you should read mine.
Well, I guess, you know, the who is this for, right? What is the problem this is trying to solve? And it's really thinking about what is the life that I want to live. It's essentially the same sort of stuff that I'm trying to help people wrestle through with the life theme, and totally different approach to doing it. I don't have a book, and I don't have a PhD, and I'm not teaching a college level class, but I guess like the people that I have worked through a life theme with, if they were to come to me and be like, you know what, I don't like your life theme, give me a book to read instead, because I really like your book recommendations. I just don't like the way that you teach this thing. I would recommend this. I don't have a better resource.
Sure.
Maybe there is one out there. I'll continue to look for it, but haven't found it yet.
Well, as far as your Obsidian property thing goes, you could use a scale of 0 to 10 in Obsidian and then use your, like a 9 would be a 4.5. And
that's
have
true.
It translate using DataView. You could do that. I have no qualms with a half star. I think your whole, like Max Sparky, like sure, great, but I'm perfectly happy with a half star. I have no issues with that. Like Amazon reports things in half stars. It's got to be okay.
It reports things, but when you rate something, what are your options?
Yes.
1, 2, 3, 4, or 5.
Yep. It's true. That is true. I'm perfectly happy with a half star. So.
Okay.
Besides, we'd have all this retro stuff we'd have to figure out what to do with.
Yeah.
And I can't just script rewrite all of the episode.
That's fair.
And how we recorded it. Okay, style and rating. So style of this book, I like the stories. I like the idea of taking a story, process it, and then give me some questions to process through it at the end. I think if I had taken the time to go through this entire book in the span of 15 weeks, so I'm taking a chapter a week and doing all of those, probably going to be something that I get more out of, and I could probably understand it at a deeper level. But I could also say that for about any book we read. So that's an obvious. I'm aware that we don't cover this. We're not covering this book in the way it's intended to be processed. I do know at the beginning, they do mention that you need to cut yourself some slack and that you shouldn't be too hard on yourself. So I'm aware that they start off with that. So you haven't even got into the book before they're already starting to tell you, like, it's okay to come up a little bit short on some of this stuff. So I'm aware of that. So I'm grateful that they do offer that. The dip thing, where we're going to start at the top, go to the bottom, come back to the top, I think I understand why they're doing that. If you process it in the scheme of, we're going to do this in 15 weeks, which I don't know if that's how they do it or not. This is how I am thinking about it. Because if you're starting at the top where you're talking about your actions and your habits, and then we're going to go down to the hard to process stuff of the self-transcendent, very high level view of things, and then we're going to come all the way back to action. If you do that over the span of 15 weeks, it takes you from, here's where your starting point is, here's what you're currently doing, here's how we get down all the way to the meaning of your life, and then here's how you start acting on that meaning in life. If you do that over that span of time, like, I could see how that would be a little more motivating and could drive you to some actions. When you do this in 2 weeks and you're like going from top to bottom to top in the span of probably a few days, it gets to be a little bit jarring. So I wonder if there's a little bit of like the translation from a class into a book just didn't go well. And the way that we are processing this book has us processing it or like reviewing it in a way that's unfair. So I need to put that caveat on this. That all said, the beginning and ending parts, I feel like I understand well enough and can resonate with. There's some real weird stuff to me in the middle, and there's some parts of it that kind of made me think you guys are weird and crazy, or I just don't understand. And again, I'm leaving that as a caveat. Since I don't have issues with half stars, unlike Max, Sparky, and Mike, I will rate it at the 3.5 because I don't think it's in that 4 territory, and I don't think it's quite as bad as a 3, so I am going to put it at 3.5. If somebody ever figures out how to put us onto the 0 scale, I'll make that change, but I don't see that happening. So 177 books deep, and we're not on that yet, so here we are. Anyway, I'll do a 3.5.
All right, let's shelf it. What's next, Joe?
The next is another Bookworm Club recommendation. This is The Good Life by Robert Waldinger and Mark Schmitz. I think we talked about this a little bit last time. Mark Schmitz is no relation, I'm assuming, at least that you're aware of.
Nope.
Okay, just checking on it. But this is probably going to be in the same vein. I have not actually picked it up to start reading it. Like, I have it at my house, but I've not actually started reading it. So I'm like, gonna guess it's going to be in the same territory as the one we just covered.
By the way, it's Mark Schultz, I believe, not Schmitz.
What? How did I get that wrong? I totally thought it was Schmitz. Did I just think it was your name?
Probably.
Oh.
I mean, it still looks like a good book, and I'm glad you picked it, but...
Now I'm frustrated.
I'm not personally invested in this one like you thought I was.
Well, my bad. Mark Schmitz apparently doesn't exist in the scheme of what I thought. Mark Schultz is what you said?
Yeah, I'm sure Mark Schmitz is out there somewhere.
I would assume so, yes. My bad. Anyway, what's after that one, Mike?
Good question. So I've been going back and forth between a couple of them, but I think I'm going to pick one that I really want to exist in the Bookworm canon.
Okay.
There is a book that is very popular that we have never read, and it is called The E-Myth Revisited by Michael Gerber.
Oh.
And this, I know, is a businessy book, so hopefully you're still interested in this one, but yeah, I think it'll be a fun conversation, and it's going to be one of those ones that I'm adding links to the show notes from for a long time to come.
This is one of those that's like polarizing, right? Like, this is one of those that people either love or hate.
Kinda, yeah.
Didn't they cover this on Cortex at one point?
They did. Yep.
Okay. I'm like nervous about that one now. Okay. All right.
Sorry.
I mean, I'm with you in that we should definitely cover this. That doesn't make me not nervous about it though.
That's fair. All right. You got any gap books?
No, with the conference and everything going on and all sorts of craziness, absolutely not. I'm itching for our ministry season to start. That way I can get some time off.
I actually do have one.
Okay.
So I am about 75% of the way through a book called How to Be Miserable, 40 Strategies You Already Use by Randy J. Patterson.
Okay.
This is kind of a parody of the of a self-help book. It's broken down into 4 different parts, and each part has 20 different strategies. And it's basically the inverse of everything you've ever heard in the productivity world, like make sure you get enough sleep and make sure you eat right. So they're written as ways to be miserable, right? And so it is kind of like satirical. You can sleep when you're dead. You know, you should stay up as long as possible. Try to work as soon as you get up. Keep your phone by your bed so you don't lose any time. Like that sort of thing. It's quite humorous for people like me who have been in this world for quite a while. But there's probably people who would pick this up and be like, what? I don't get it. I think you would find it pretty funny, though.
I wrote it down to buy it. So that's... immediately what I'm, yes, as soon as I'm done here.
If you think it's any good, maybe we can talk about it for Bookworm. But
have to do like an After Dark episode.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a satirical thing.
I like it.
All right. So thank you to everyone who supports the show. Thank you for listening. Thank you if you have attended the live recording. Thank you specifically if you are a Bookworm Club premium member and you support the show financially. It really means a lot to Joe and myself. Helps us keep the lights on. If you want to become a Bookworm Club premium member, you can go to bookworm.fm/membership. $5 a month, $50 a year. And that gets you an access to the pro feed, which is the ad-free version. Also a bootleg version, which Joe publishes right after we wrap up. So you get to hear all of the technical issues we encounter, all of the stupid things we say that Toby edits out in the main episode. That's all in the bootleg. And then I've got the mind map files for all of the books that we have read. Those are available in both PDF and MindNode format for Bookworm Club premium members. So again, if you want to support the show, we would love to have you join us. Bookworm.fm/membership.
One other side note about the bootleg. You also get to hear like the pre and post conversations we have.
That's true.
On the episode. Like I think today we were talking about racing electric cars. So like, yeah, anyway, all sorts of fun stuff. So if you're one of these amazing people that reads along with us, pick up The Good Life by Robert Waldinger and Mark Schmitz. And we'll cover that with you in a couple of weeks.